The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. From Time Magazine today, it's the issue August 31/September 7, 2020. It features the usual Time red border around the cover, as well as a bold T-I-M-E in red near the top of the cover page. Embellishing the cover is the partially embroidered, it's actually a photo of the embroidery, U.S. flag with the stars and the stripes, the red, white, and dark blue. And near the bottom of the most right-hand stripe, there are only seven red stripes appearing. There's a needle tucked under some thread. So the flag's only partly completed here in this depiction. And the artist is Nika Jones. The first article then, The Brief Time with Veep, V-E-E-P, creator Armando Iannucci, says, these times call for Charles Dickens, by Dan Stewart. In 1837, Charles Dickens moved into a narrow terraced house north of central London. 48 Doughty Street was the novelist's home for only 2.5 years, but they were productive ones. He wrote Oliver Twist and Nicholas Nickleby there. Today the building is a museum dedicated to the author and his work, and it was here in February that Time met Armando Iannucci. The screenwriter and director whose newest film is an adaptation of Dickens' The Personal History of David Copperfield, released in the U.S. August 28. The house has been restored to how it might have looked when Dickens lived. His well-worn desk takes pride of place in the study, and the dining room is laid out as if for a supper party. When we met there, the museum was still open to the public, so we retreated to a meeting room decorated only with a whiteboard. It was here that Dickens delivered his PowerPoint presentations, Iannucci deadpans. Iannucci, that's I-A-N-N-U-C-C-I, may be best known to U.S. audiences as creator of HBO's Veep, the Emmy-winning political satire starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus as a vain and power-hungry vice president. But in his native UK, he has the status of a comedy icon, primarily for his role in helping create the character Alan Partridge, the brash and clueless TV presenter played by Steve Coogan. In the 2000s, he made The Thick of It, a foul-mouthed satire of the Tony Blair era that was a spiritual forerunner to Veep. His success at HBO has given him license to pursue more ambitious projects, movies like 2017's The Death of Stalin, a dark comedy set in communist-era Russia, and now Copperfield. It is a departure in some ways. There's very little profanity for a start, and it is pitched at a broad audience. Far from being cynical, it's generally optimistic about humanity, but it also has the streak of absurdity that runs through all of Iannucci's work, and one eye on the inequality and social mores of the time. I have never seen it as a departure because I grew up loving Dickens anyway, so it is like a return to the writer who most inspired me, he says. His desire to mock social politics and social behavior comes from Dickens, and silliness. It's always good to have a bit of silly. Performing comedy, Iannucci has honed a poker-face delivery, enunciating carefully crafted sentences with a lilting rhythm in his gentle Scots accent. In conversation, he's more discursive. His answers run into each other, often whipping round a tangent before coming to his point. Iannucci was born in Glasgow in 1963 to Italian parents and studied English literature at Glasgow University and at Oxford before taking up comedy full-time. In his early shows on BBC Radio and TV, he gathered a team of collaborators interested in brainy, often surreal comedy, fondly remembered by Britain's Generation Xers. Over the 15 years in which he made The Thick of It, its movie adaptation, In the Loop, set in the run-up to the Iraq War and then Veep, he accumulated a reputation as Britain's foremost satirical mind. His work appeared to expose the crude mechanics of politics, the obsession with surface over substance, and the bitter and cynical people attracted to it. Then, in 2015, something changed. He left Veep ahead of its final season and shifted focus from the contemporary to either the past, in movies like Stalin, or the far future, in his HBO science fiction comedy, Avenue 5. In the Trump era, he says, satire struggled to keep up with reality. The rules keep changing, if there are any rules, he says. We have an impeachment trial, but we won't call any witnesses. Trump says he could go out and shoot a man on Fifth Avenue and still win. That suggests to me there are no rules. Iannucci reread David Copperfield around 2010 and was inspired to make it as a movie, but it was not until he had completed work on Stalin that he felt equipped to tackle the book's mix of comedy, melodrama, and tragedy. The novel follows the eponymous character as he passes through the social strata of Victorian England, from a loving childhood to the privations of a bottling factory and boarding school, on the path to becoming a famous writer. Much of the book was based on Dickens' own life, and he writes of struggling to belong. This is a story that may have been written almost 200 years ago, but it still has themes that are current today, Iannucci says. He wanted the movie to feel new. I said to everyone on the production team, let us pretend there has not been a period drama or costume drama before, he said. Let us not do clouds of fog and pickpockets. He tried to reimagine what a historical drama might look like, filling the movie with bright primary colors and letting his camera dance around the actors. But first, there was the matter of casting David. Iannucci says he only ever had one actor in mind, Dev Patel, the British Indian actor who shot to fame in Slumdog Millionaire and was nominated for an Oscar for his role in Lion. He could be funny and gauche, but yet strong and focused and decisive, Iannucci says. I really couldn't think of anyone else. Patel asked him how they would explain the fact he is not white. He said, so what? It's my father, my dead father. Is he Indian? And I said, no, I have chosen you because you're the best person for the part. And so I thought, let's cast everyone else that way as well. So around half the faces in the movie are those of Black and Asian Brits. The diversity of the cast was much scrutinized by British reviewers when the film came out in the UK, but, says Iannucci, it usually is not mentioned after people have seen the film. They just say, that was a great cast. Everyone was great. He believes the UK is somewhat behind the US when it comes to diversity and casting. Dev said, Normally, a thing like this, I would be the guy standing at the door with the tray. Iannucci says he was primarily motivated by a desire to choose from 100% of the acting community available to me, rather than 85%, but adds that, for the film he wanted to make, it made sense for the cast to reflect the people in the movie theater. I did not want people to feel, we're watching the past. I want them to feel, you are in this story, and therefore it is now. Whether there will be people in the theater to watch Copperfield seemed more like a certainty when we first spoke. On a phone call in late June, Iannucci says he hopes audiences will be able to find a way to see it on a big screen. It is a film that has a sense of community and a family, and I want people to experience that together if they can, safely. Like many, Iannucci experienced those early months of the pandemic with an uneasy sense of time slowing down. I did not think I was going to be productive, he says. Isolating with his family in his home north of London, he worked on the second season of Avenue 5. What has really struck him, he says, has been the utterly transparent inability of the government to handle the pandemic. In the UK especially, but also in the US. The fact that wearing a face mask has become a political decision, it is bonkers. The writer believes many more people are now seeing through the carefully packaged untruths and confidence trickery of our modern leaders. When this is all over, he predicts, there will be a great reckoning. A great reckoning is going to come. There is a photo here of Armando Iannucci seated on a settee. It's probably velvet, but I'm really unable to determine what the texture is. It's a deep, deep blue-green, like a deep sea green with some blue in it. And Iannucci is seated on it dressed in blue. He's probably got blue dungarees, although they may be some other type of blue twill pants and a blue shirt, over which is a dark blue, like navy blue, blazer. He's looking directly into the camera. He has brown eyes, balding hair, and grayish hair. And his hands are more or less folded on his lap. His legs are crossed, but leaning up against his left arm is a statuette, the bust of, one supposes, Charles Dickens. It's a fellow done in bronze with a beard and sort of wavy hair. In the background, there are the Victorian or Edwardian, I'm sorry, I don't know which, draperies in deep, sheeny red with gold facing or lining and red fringes. The wallpaper in the background is kind of a lavender blue-gray striped. There are definitely elongated top-to-bottom stripes, and in between there's some kind of a floral motif as if it were stamped. There is a sconce with a candle on one wall, and that is directly next to a heavily gilt-framed portrait of a younger man at a writing desk. Without any caption, one cannot be sure, but it may be a younger depiction of Charles Dickens. The risk report, Putin Won't Ride to the Rescue of Belarus's Strong Man, by Ian Bremmer. Another government friendly to Moscow is in trouble as Belarus continues to be gripped by protests following rigged presidential elections August 9. Many expect to see Russia's Vladimir Putin intervene. Alexander Lukashenko, Belarus's president for the past 26 years, certainly hopes Putin steps in to bail him out. He would be better off spending that time packing his bags. Russia's invasion of Georgia in 2008 and Ukraine in 2014, and the enthusiasm with which it jumped into the Syrian morass, have given the impression in recent years Putin has a very low threshold when it comes to meddling in the affairs of others. But Belarus is a different story. Instead of looking to Georgia and Ukraine, it is more instructive to look at the case of Armenia, where another Moscow-friendly government fell in 2018. Rather than marching in to ensure its preferred candidate held on to power, Moscow opted to work with Armenia's opposition to negotiate a political transition in the country. Russia got to keep its outside influence in Armenian politics as a result, and at minimal cost. Putin's gunning for the same outcome in Belarus. It's made possible by the fact that the protests in Belarus are not anti-Russian or pro-Western, as Ukraine protests were, but specifically anti-Lukashenko. According to polls out of MGIMO University, as recently as November, nearly 90% of Belarusians wanted to be on some kind of friendly terms with Russia. 10% preferred a more neutral relationship. Just 0.2% wanted relations to be hostile. Putin wants to keep it that way. Sending in Russian troops uninvited by those currently on the streets would only serve to make enemies of the Belarusian people, and Moscow already has enough of those. Moscow has said it would deploy troops to Belarus in case of foreign interference, but that should be read more as a warning shot against NATO and Western interference in Russia's orbit of power than an intention to use the military. For Putin, stepping in to prop up Lukashenko would also put Russia in the crosshairs of major EU and US sanctions, an outcome Moscow would have been desperate to avoid even before the coronavirus began squeezing the global economy. At this point, the Russian economy is in no shape to shoulder the political and economic costs of further military adventurism. If Lukashenko were a particularly loyal or competent Russian ally operating out of Minsk, Putin might have been more tempted to intervene decisively. But that ship has sailed. At this point, the smart money's on Russia's working behind the scenes on a brokered political transition to ensure it keeps its privileged position within the Belarusian government, no matter who emerges from the political fray. Of course, just because this is Moscow's preferred outcome does not mean a Russia-approved political transition will play out. It is possible that a transfer of power comes in spite of Russia's best efforts to control the outcome, in which case the eventual government in Minsk could well tilt toward Brussels rather than Moscow, a worst-case scenario for Putin. It is also possible Lukashenko manages to hold on to power so long as his security services remain loyal, leading to a Venezuela-like situation on Russia's own border, an outcome that would be as tragic as it would be ironic, given Russia's past support of Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro. But as the protests intensify, both of these outcomes are long shots. The only longer shot is that Russia's military will step in. History, a small off-white column here. Disaster non-response. At the bottom of this short column, it shows a photograph of rather heavily shrouded people, actually. One supposes they're female, but it's indeterminate. There, a group of people is seated at a table. All are clad in white, long sleeves, high collars, caps on heads, masks on faces, with an additional individual standing behind the group of five seated at the table. Behind the people hangs a U.S. flag, and I can't count all the stars, but based upon the symmetry of the field of stars, there are probably 48 there. They're non-asymmetrical, as our 50 stars now occupy the field. There's a cross. Now, this photo's in black and white. So there's a cross, a large block print cross on white, and another poster that says something like, if I fail, he dies. And there's another dark cross superimposed on that poster. At a time when one recent poll shows two-thirds of Americans believe the U.S. pandemic response is worse than that of other countries, a look back at the 1918 influenza pandemic reveals that a chaotic White House response to a public health emergency is nothing new. There was no leadership or guidance of any kind directly from the White House, says John M. Barry, author of The Great Influenza, the story of the deadliest pandemic in history. Woodrow Wilson was focused on World War I, which was going on at the same time, and thought anything negative was viewed as hurting morale and hurting the war effort. In Shall We Wake the President? Two Centuries of Disaster Management from the Oval Office, Tevi Troy calls Wilson the worst president in a disaster and notes that he fueled the spread of the virus by continuing troop mobilizations even near the end of the war. He never even issued a statement about the illness. Ultimately, the 1918 flu killed about six times the number of Americans killed in World War I. And that column was written by Melissa August and Olivia B. Waxman. The View essay, Continuing My Great-Grandmother's Fight, by Michelle Duster. Here's a formal portrait, and it is historical, based upon the dress of the occupants of the portrait. It is a formal sitting. There is an adult female, two young boys, and two young girls. The boys are decked out in suits. One is wearing a tie with his white shirt. The other appears not to wear a tie, but he has a handkerchief in his suit coat breast pocket. The two girls are likewise dressed very well in white dresses, or at least light-colored dresses. The photo's in black and white with a sepia tone. Long sleeves, lacy edges. The smallest, who's in the front, has white leggings on. The older girl, seated behind the littlest one, has two big white bows in her hair. And standing behind them with a hand on a shoulder of each of the boys is a very proper-looking woman. We see only the top half of her, but the bodice of her dress is very well tailored with a lot of fancy work around the collar. Her hair is done in a pompadour. It is smooth and then heavy on top with probably curls. Nobody's really smiling. Everyone looks quite formal in this portrait. And these are people of color. The caption reads, Wells in Chicago in 1909 with her children Charles, Herman, Ida, and Elfrida. My great-grandmother, Ida B. Wells, was a suffragist. You probably have not heard her described this way before. She's most often honored for her journalism exposing lynchings in the South. To me, she is what great-grandmothers are to many, a teacher. From Ida, I learned that there is no end to a fight for justice. While the most famous suffragists, Alice Paul, Carrie Chapman Catt, ended their fight in 1920, Ida did not. She continued to push for black women's voting access for the rest of her life and taught me lessons that I take into my fight for suffrage. I, too, am a suffragist because in 2020, many Americans still do not have access to the vote. I grew up hearing about Ida's willingness to speak up against injustice, inequality, and indignity, about her refusal to be silenced, sidelined, or marginalized. I heard about the time she would not go to the colored car on the Chesapeake, Ohio, and Southwestern Railroad in 1884, and rather than leave the car, for which she had purchased a ticket, she was forced off. She promptly secured an attorney and sued the railroad. I heard about the time when in 1892, three of her friends were lynched. because they owned a grocery store that competed against a white-owned store. And she wrote about it so much in the Memphis Free Speech newspaper that her own life was threatened. She encouraged black people to use what little power they had to protest, to boycott, and ultimately to leave Memphis if they had the means to do so. She was not interested in being second in anything. She learned pride and deserving attitude from her father, my great-great-grandfather, James Wells, who spent most of his life enslaved in Mississippi. After the Civil War ended and black men got the right to vote through the 15th Amendment in 1870, he and his friends met at the house to talk politics. He encouraged Ida, who was among the first generation of formerly enslaved people to become legally educated, to read the newspaper to them. She learned people should be politically and socially engaged in shaping their own destiny. She learned her voice was important. When her father cast his vote for a different candidate than the man who had enslaved him suggested, he lost his carpentry tools and house. Rather than be discouraged, he rebuilt and continued to live life on his own terms. Ida learned from her father to do what was in her heart and be willing to suffer the consequences. Sometimes the price of dignity came with the loss of something else, and that was okay. Ida attended Shaw University, now Rust College, but still could not cast her vote like her father. She did not have the right to vote in 1892 when she spoke out against the murder of her friends. She did not have the right to vote in 1893 when she traveled to the UK to speak about the atrocities of lynching. She did not have the right to vote in 1896 when she co-founded the National Association of Colored Women. She did not have the right to vote in 1909 when she co-founded the NAACP. In 1913, the women of Illinois gained partial suffrage, which gave them the ability to vote in presidential and municipal elections. Ida dived into taking advantage of this new right. With the assistance of two white colleagues, Belle Squire and Virginia Brooks, she founded the Alpha Suffrage Club, the first all-black suffrage club in the state, in order to exercise the power of the vote. She was also selected to represent the club at the 1913 suffrage parade in Washington, D.C., with the integrated Illinois delegation. In deference to Southern white women, the organizers of the parade asked black women to march in the back. My great-grandmother famously refused that request. After all, she was 50 years old, had been fighting for racial and gender equality for more than 30 years, had founded a suffrage club herself. She was not about to comply with a request from white women who were half her age, or any white woman for that matter. As the parade proceeded down Pennsylvania Avenue, my great-grandmother took advantage of the chaos, got lost in the crowd, then inserted herself front and center of the Illinois delegation. She deserved to have that place in history, and she knew it. Ida's refusal to comply fortifies me whenever I face my own dilemmas of making myself small in order to placate someone else. Do I remain silent and compliant, or do I speak up? Do I play their game in order to make them feel comfortable, or do I run the risk of being considered difficult and be true to myself? I must speak up. I must not accept mistreatment silently. In 1920, 100 years ago this month, the 19th Amendment was adopted, theoretically giving women the vote on a national basis. But the fight for women's suffrage did not end in 1920. Many women of color were unable to vote until the Voting Rights Act was signed in 1965 and extended in 1970 and 1975. When we honor suffragists, we should not only think of Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, or even my great-grandmother. Women of color in more recent history rightfully need to be considered among them. African Americans such as Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Baker, and Latinx women including Dolores Huerta and Felisa Rincon de Gautier, fought for suffrage well into the 1960s and beyond. Even today, we're witnessing efforts to implement barriers to voting that disproportionately affect communities of color. Even today, we're fighting for suffrage. There are increasingly strict requirements for voter IDs that are more difficult for people of color and younger voters to obtain. Laws in targeted areas that now require voters to have a street address, which discriminates against people who use P.O. boxes or do not have a permanent physical address. Fewer voting materials available in different languages. Voter roll purges, eliminating millions of eligible people of color based on small discrepancies in how their names appear or how recently they voted. The disenfranchisement of those with felony records in most states. Lack of funding for elections in specific districts, which has contributed to malfunctioning voter machines in areas that are highly populated with people of color. Reduction of early voting days and hours, plus last-minute changes in voting locations that have disproportionately targeted communities of color, which effectively makes voting impossible for people who do shift work or lack flexible work hours. The combination of all these barriers has reduced the number of people of color who've been able to cast their votes. More than 100 years ago, my great-grandmother fought so all women could win. She showed up, she wrote, she organized, spoke, and advocated for change while raising four children. Little did she know that women of color would need to fight for several more decades. Now, 89 years after she died, it is time for white Americans, all Americans, to continue the fight for her. During this centennial year of the 19th Amendment, it's important and exciting to acknowledge the determination and sacrifice of those who worked to pass it. But in the midst of the tributes and celebrations, we need to dismantle the false narrative of a whites-only suffrage movement and broaden the scope to be inclusive and reflect reality. The next generation is watching and will be inspired by the truth. Michelle Duster, who wrote this essay, is author of the forthcoming book, Ida B. the Queen, The Extraordinary Life and Legacy of Ida B. Wells. The Wages of Hate. On the evening of February 6, as U.S. news networks reported the death of a doctor in Wuhan, China, who had warned of a deadly new virus, thousands of Americans were tuning into a different kind of show. "The good news is, I heard actually that you can't get this if you're white," Nick Fuentes, a far-right political commentator, told viewers on his America First channel on the streaming platform DLive. "You're only really susceptible to the virus if you're Asian," Fuentes continued. "I think we'll be okay." Fuentes, 22, a prolific podcaster who on his shows has compared the Holocaust to a cookie-baking operation, argued the segregation of black Americans was better for them, and the First Amendment was not written for Muslims, is doing better than okay during the COVID-19 pandemic. He is part of a loose cohort of far-right provocateurs, white nationalists, and right-wing extremists who've built large, engaged audiences on lesser-known platforms like DLive after being banned from mainstream sites for spreading hate speech and conspiracy theories. The model can be lucrative. Viewers pay to watch the live streams through subscriptions and donations, and the platform allows the content creators to keep most of the revenue. Fuentes appears to have earned more than $140,000 off his DLive streams, cementing himself as the most viewed account on the platform, according to calculations provided to Time by a live streaming analyst who was granted anonymity because of the work tracking these accounts. Fuentes is hardly alone, and that's spelled F-U-E-N-T-E-S. 8 of the 10 top earners on DLive this year, as ranked by Social Blade, a social media analytics website, are far-right commentators, white nationalist extremists, or conspiracy theorists. The social disruption and economic dislocation caused by the virus, as well as the nationwide protests and civil unrest that followed the death of George Floyd in late May, has helped fuel this growing, shadowy, alt-tech industry. As public spaces shut down in March, millions of Americans logged online. The live streaming sector soared 45% from March to April, according to a study by software sites Stream Elements and Arsenal.gg. As people became more socially isolated, many increasingly turned to pundits peddling misinformation, conspiracy theories, and hate speech. And even as mainstream platforms cracked down on far-right propagandists, other online audiences grew. Over the past 5 months, more than 50 popular accounts reviewed by Time on sites like DLive have multiplied their viewership and raked in tens of thousands of dollars in online currency by insisting COVID-19 is fake or exaggerated, encouraging followers to resist lockdown orders, and broadcasting racist tropes during the nationwide protests over police brutality. Many of these users, including Fuentes, had been banned by major social media platforms like YouTube for violating policies prohibiting hate speech. But this so-called deplatforming merely pushed them to migrate to less regulated portals, where some have attracted bigger audiences and gamed algorithms to make even more money. In addition, clips of their broadcasts on less trafficked sites still frequently make it onto YouTube, Twitter, and other mainstream platforms, essentially serving as free advertising for their streams elsewhere, experts say. As social media giants like YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook target hate speech and misinformation, sites like DLive seem to be turning a blind eye, former users and employees say, recognizing that much of their traffic and revenue comes from these accounts. They care more about having good numbers than weeding these people out, a former employee of DLive, who was granted anonymity because he still works in the live streaming sector, tells Time. DLive did not respond to multiple requests for comments, which means ordinary users on gaming and streaming platforms, many of them teenagers, are often one click away from white nationalist content. Many of these far-right personalities allege they're being unfairly censored for conservative political commentary or provocative humor, not hate speech. Most of these viewers will not respond to streamers' often cartoonish calls to action like "Film your hospital movement in April," meant to show that no patients were there, thus proving COVID-19 was fake. But this murky ecosystem of casual viewers, right-wing trolls, and the occasional diehard acolyte creates a real challenge for technology companies and law enforcement agencies. And it does not take much to trigger a tragedy. Over the past 2 years, terrorists inspired by online right-wing propaganda have live-streamed their own deadly attacks in New Zealand and Germany. In March 2019, a Florida man who'd been radicalized by far-right media and online conspiracy theorists pleaded guilty to sending more than a dozen pipe bombs to prominent critics of President Donald Trump, A month later, a gunman armed with an AR-15 shot four people, killing one, in a synagogue in Poway, California, after allegedly posting a racist and anti-Semitic screed on the site 8chan. About 3 months later, a man killed 23 people at a Walmart in El Paso, Texas, after posting a racist manifesto online, according to authorities. With COVID-19 continuing to surge in parts of the country, ongoing protests over racial injustice and the upcoming 2020 U.S. presidential election, the next few months promise to offer fertile ground for bad actors in unmoderated virtual spaces. Far-right propagandists are really capitalizing on this conspiratorial moment, says Brian Friedberg, a senior researcher at Harvard University's Shorenstein Center's Technology and Social Change Project. Everyone's locked inside. While there is what they refer to as a race war happening outside their windows that they're reporting on, so this is prime content for white nationalist spaces. The migration of far-right personalities to DLive illustrates how, despite mainstream platforms' recent crackdowns, the incentives that govern this ecosystem are thriving. Anyone with an internet connection can continue to leverage conspiracy theories, racism, and misogyny for attention and money, experts say. The migration of hate speech to far-flung corners of the internet could make it harder to track, increasing the risk that it spills into the offline world. Experts say law enforcement and national security agencies are still unprepared to tackle right-wing extremism. They lack expertise not only in the rapidly evolving technology, but also in the ideological ecosystem that has spawned a battery of far-right movements. The recently repackaged white nationalist youth movement, with new names like America First or the Groypers, looks more like gussied-up campus conservatives, as Friedberg of Harvard's Shorenstein Center puts it, so they're not triggering the same warning bells. Recent incidents show how this online environment that blends political commentary and hate speech can be dangerous. An 18-year-old accused of firebombing a Delaware Planned Parenthood clinic in January was identified through his Instagram profile, which contained far-right memes reflecting popular beliefs in the young white nationalist movement, according to BuzzFeed News. In June, Facebook deactivated nearly 200 social media accounts with ties to white nationalist groups, rallying members to attend Black Lives Matter protests, in some cases armed with weapons. Analysts who track extremist recruitment online also warn the pandemic may have long-term effects on young people who are now spending far more time on the internet. Without the structure of school and social activities, many children and teenagers are spending hours a day in spaces where extremist content lurks alongside games and other benign entertainment, says Dana Kester, an associate professor at West Virginia University, who researches the impact of online white extremism on youth in Appalachia. It is common, she notes, to see teenagers sharing Black Lives Matter messages alongside racist cartoons from popular Instagram accounts targeting middle schoolers. So many parents I've spoken with say their kids are on devices until 3 in the morning, she says. I cannot begin to imagine how much damage can be done with kids that many hours a day, marinating in really toxic content. Analysts warn both U.S. law enforcement and big technology companies need to move quickly to hire experts who understand this new extremist ecosystem. Experts say the mainstream platforms' recent purges are reactive, they patch yesterday's problems instead of preventing future abuses and focus on high-profile provocateurs instead of underlying networks. One solution may be to follow the money as content creators migrate to new platforms in search of new financial opportunities. White supremacists have become particularly assiduous at exploiting new methods of fundraising, often seeking out platforms that have not yet realized how extremists can exploit them, said George Selam, senior vice president of programs of Anti-Defamation League, in testimony before a House subcommittee in January. When a new fundraising method or platform emerges, white supremacists can find a window of opportunity. These windows can, however, be shut if platforms promptly take countermeasures. On the evening of August 11, Joe Biden's pick of Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate dominated the news. "She hates white people," Fuentes told viewers on DLive. "She's going to use the full weight of the federal government to destroy conservatives, to destroy America first, anybody that speaks up for white people." NBC and ABC News, which have a combined 13 million subscribers on YouTube, had an average of 6,100 concurrent viewers watching their coverage. Fuentes' show had 9,000. This article was slightly abridged, and it was reported by Alejandro de la Garza. Time off movies. Here are a couple of movie reviews. Teenage Trauma for Young and Old. In troubling times, it sometimes helps to look back on even more troubling times. To that end, Chemical Hearts, directed by Richard Tan, Southside with You, and adapted from Crystal Sutherland's young adult novel, invites all you scarred former teenagers to relive the trauma of high school romance. Aspiring writer and newly minted senior Henry Page, the raffishly appealing Austin Abrams, is waiting for his life to begin. Enter Grace Town, Lily Reinhart of Riverdale, a bristly, brainy transfer student who walks with the aid of a cane. The two meet as Henry looks over her shoulder, reading the line from a Pablo Neruda poem she has highlighted. This highly annoying maneuver pays off, though Grace harbors a painful secret that threatens their fledgling romance. Painful secrets, it is true, are a dime a dozen, but that does not keep Chemical Hearts from being almost embarrassingly enjoyable. If Grace and Henry can survive the perils of first love, there's got to be hope for the rest of us. Reliving all that anxiety makes adulthood look better. At least a little. Another movie review here, In Brighton Beach, Yearning to Belong by Stephanie Zakarik, who also wrote the review I just read. Sometimes a movie works because in the first few minutes of watching, you realize you want the best for a character. You will settle for nothing less. That's the allure of Lingua Franca, the third film from writer-director Isabel Sandoval. Sandoval stars as Olivia, an undocumented Filipina working as a live-in caretaker for the elderly, if still peppery, Olga, the late Lynn Cohen, in Brooklyn's Brighton Beach. Olivia is also a trans woman, which adds layers of complexity to her life. In the wake of Trump's hardcore anti-immigrant proclamations, she's desperate to marry a U.S. citizen so she can obtain a green card. Olivia's mission is a practical one. She is not looking for love. Then Olga's irresponsible, though perhaps not irredeemable, grandson, Alex, Eamon Farron, moves in, igniting sparks. Olivia's caution in the face of romantic danger and her anxiety over being deported become the twin poles of her life. even as her mother frequently calls from home, looking for the allowance that Olivia so dutifully sends. Lingua Franca, which made a splash at the Venice Film Festival last year, the first film by a trans woman to be featured at the festival, is a gorgeous and delicate picture, an understated work that opens a window on an intimate world. Shot by Isaac Banks, it captures the lived-in luster of greater New York City's older, not-so-rapidly-gentrifying neighborhoods. Olivia's a relative newcomer to this world, easing warily into its landscape. Yet as Sandoval plays her, she's an old soul who already belongs. She radiates luminous warmth. If Olivia has fought hard just to become herself, there is nothing calloused about her spirit. She seeks tenderness and security in an environment that dangles those things just out of her grasp. She is asking for so little. It is enough to make you want to give her the world. Lingua Franca, streaming on Netflix, and Chemical Hearts, streaming on Amazon. Eben Shapiro writes this column, 9 Questions, of Harold L. Martin, chancellor of the nation's largest historically black university, on returning students to campus, Trump's boasting, and the choice of Kamala Harris. As head of North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University, what was your reaction to Senator Harris, a graduate of Howard, another HBCU, as Joe Biden's running mate? Answer: Senator Harris embodies so much that's important and worthy about historically black universities, and it is truly a historic moment to see one of our graduates included on the Democratic ticket. We join our friends at Howard in their celebration of this extraordinary development. Question: how have HBCUs fared under the current administration? Now, HBCU is an acronym for Historically Black Colleges and Universities. HBCUs have fared well in federal funding over the past 3 years. Title III support has increased, $85 million in annual STEM funding for HBCUs was made permanent, and year-round funding for Pell Grants was approved. Passage of all those reflect positively on the president and his administration. Question: so when you see the president tweeting, "My administration has done more for the black community than any president since Abraham Lincoln," how do you respond to that? Answer: well, I am insulted, quite honestly. I am sort of appalled by the notion that one would make such a claim. Question: what do you think of his leadership at a time of great social unrest in the wake of the murder of George Floyd? Answer: I think he tends to inflame situations and tends to divide versus providing a voice that's healing for our nation on the heels of COVID-19, where there's been evidence of so many missteps by the administration. Question: yet you are optimistic. Answer: probably as optimistic as I have been. I do feel it's in a different moment. The corporate boards I serve on, we have a very different conversation with our board members about what this means and how we must rethink the way we do business. I spend enormous amounts of my time engaging with our students, and I believe because of the great history and traditions of our university as an institution actively involved in social change over the decades, and because of my own experiences growing up in America as an African-American individual, overlapping into periods of segregation and Jim Crow, my experiences tell me this feels different. This is more than just about police brutality. This is also very significantly about disparities in America that are embedded in racism through education, healthcare, unemployment, wealth, etc. Question: students are back on campus. Despite all the safety precautions, I know recently you have felt guarded reluctance. What's your current feeling? Answer: guarded, but comfortable. Question: UNC Chapel Hill, part of your same system, just abruptly moved classes to virtual after an outbreak of COVID-19 among returning students. Can you tick off some of the things you're doing to keep your students healthy and safe? Answer. All of our students who are returning to campus have been checked for symptoms as they move into the residence hall. Question. What else? Answer. We're obviously requiring masking, safe social distancing. We have a high-intensity cleansing protocol on a daily basis and a daily morning ritual of self-assessment of all students living in residence halls, and each of our classrooms was reduced to about 30% occupancy. Question. What's been the initial reaction to the health protocols, including canceling your historic homecoming? Answer. Our students are responding overall. They are 18, 19, 20-year-olds, though, so we have to continue to remind them of the expectations, quite honestly. Again, those were 9 questions of Harold L. Martin, head of North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University. What readers said about the plague election, Tim O'Brien's cover art for the August 1724 issue, which accompanied Molly Ball's story about COVID-19 pandemic. Twitter users, including @PattyPan and @RobertStark79, thought the cover came at the president from too far left, but Kathleen K. Carfano of Glen Mills, Pennsylvania, quipped, when she got to the last paragraph, which ponders a future in which Americans look back on this plague, it took her a nanosecond to realize Ball was referring to the pandemic, not the current administration. That cover depicted President Trump swimming towards the White House in a blue sea contaminated with red COVID-19 balls that looked like aliens with spikes coming out of them. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our phone number is 919-832-5138.